This is the Voice of Freedom.
I tell you the truth, no matter who it hurts or helps, even if it hurts me. And oh, how you hate it. Oh, how you hate to hear the truth. Seek ye the truth, and the truth will make you free.
Out of order, I show you out of order. You don't know what out of order is.
You're not just attacking targets. You're bringing a pitiful, helpless giant to its knees.
The peoples of the world today are ready to fight America.
Now the war is going to be here, but we're going to be free.
And I still advocate revolutionary changes in the structure and in the principles that govern the United States. I advocate an end to capitalist exploitation. If that is a crime, then I am totally guilty.
The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America.
These people are psychopathic. They're out to destroy our institutions.
What's up, Hep Cadets, Cats, and Kittens? It's your host, Moxie O'Brien, back again with a special edition of Come and See here on another Friday Morning in America. And I missed you, so I'm back a little bit early. Actually, I mean, that's not untrue, but I'm actually back early because I needed to talk about something. This has been kind of one of those, hair up the ass sort of things for about a month now. You know, we talked about Hebrew Israelism on the Mox Speaks 2 episode of the show. We've kind of addressed this a little bit at a time. But in the period of time since that episode came out, the Kyrie Irving debacle happened and sort of reopened the conversation all over again. And Kyrie shared a link to, I'm not going to call it a documentary because documentary sort of connotates that there's information in it and there's not, a movie called Hebrews to Negroes by a cat named Ronald Dalton Jr. Now, this is particularly advantageous for me because Ronald Dalton Jr. lives like 45 minutes away from me. So I felt sort of compelled to look into this thing, see what it was saying, because I've noticed black people on the internet lost their goddamn minds over this thing. So I was raring to go to dig into this, see what this documentary, again, it's not a documentary, Mox, stop calling it that, this film had to say about Black Hebrew Israelism, what the film was about, what sort of it was presenting as evidence, how it had managed to attract some popular people. But I also think that's worth addressing because something that I notice a lot these days, especially with the advent of like social media giving everybody a platform and the ability to form a cult of personality around themselves, is that we assume that if you're good at one thing, it means you know things about other things, and that's not usually the case. If you're highly specialized in one area, it's usually because you don't know fuck all about anything else. So the fact that we assume that people like Kanye West, who is, again, like a rapper, and Kyrie Irving, who is a professional basketball player, know anything about history, geography, archaeology, sociology, anthropology, or any of those things is kind of a mistake on our part as a society, and I really think we need to move away from assuming that being an expert in one field qualifies you to talk about anything other than the thing we've all recognized you know about. Having said that, this film attracts a lot of people with its ideas, so I was very curious to see what exactly Mr. Dalton had to say, what some of the ideas were. So I did. And I can say, conclusively, it's a steaming hot pile of fucking horse shit based on a whole bunch of ideas that have been debunked for well over a century. And we're going to get into, as we have a tendency to do on this show, sort of a bit of detail about some of those ideas, where they came from. It's curious to me, given the way this film is framed as a piece of a black empowerment, how almost none of the ideas presented in it came from black people. And in fact, most of them came from historical colonialists, members of the Ku Klux Klan, Nazis, white supremacists, eugenicists, and people who, generally speaking, weren't so much trying to empower the black people as they hated everyone who wasn't white and their information had an agenda. And I think that it's very important to let me back up. So I think an issue that you have with propaganda and why I advise everyone to stop getting their information from like YouTube videos and shit is that what you have in this format, and this is also kind of why I don't do YouTube videos, is that a person will throw lots of pieces of data at you and just move on as though those pieces of data should be accepted. You shouldn't look into them. There's no background as to where the information came from, who is saying it, why they're saying it. And these are the things that are part of doing research, which nobody does. Research is a catchphrase for people who want confirmation biases these days. No one actually does research. And part of doing research, we're going to talk about this a little bit more in a few weeks when we talk about the anti-vax movement, but part of doing research isn't just finding a thing. It's looking at where and why that thing exists. Someone can tell you that, well, this person said that the Jews control the media, and that they concocted a plan to trick everybody into believing that they're a marginalized group when in actuality they run everything. Something that is actually touched on in the film. And we can say, oh, so that person said this. Okay, who is that person? Why did they say it? When did they say it? Where did they say it? Who did they say it to? And what was going on socially that may have influenced that statement? Those are all important pieces of information you need to look into before you just say, oh, I know a new thing now. Because especially when we're discussing things like race, ethnicity, and anything regarding anything adjacent to whiteness historically, there is an agenda involved in everyone having that conversation, and you need to know what it is before you accept what they're saying. And one of the biggest problems in a film that has a lot of goddamn problems, not the least of which are the fact that the dude who put it together didn't know how to pronounce half the things in it, spelled a lot of things incorrectly, and edited it like a child. One of the biggest problems in the film is basing a lot of evidence presented as fact on things and people who have been laughably discredited. Laughably discredited. And I'm not just talking about how the film opens with like a quote from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, or how one of the fundamental ideas expressed in it is based on a complete and total misinterpretation of Deuteronomy, or any of these things that a lot of the people who are cited, oh, this person said this thing about the ethnicity of the Xhosa people in the 1800s. Oh, dope. That person doesn't have a degree and they were a guest on Ancient Aliens. That's relevant. So I think that because I have seen so many people, and I am going to word it this way, fall for this film, I think it's important to talk about the film, kind of dissect some of its ideas, dismiss certain things because they're based on nonsense, to be perfectly honest. I mean, the film incorrectly quotes Adolf Hitler twice. It also references King Leopold II as someone who was trying to defend the history of the black Israelites. So, as a black man, this guy said that King Leopold II was trying to help black people in a secret war against the Jews. So, It's profoundly stupid. Most of it is incorrect. It's poorly researched or intentionally poorly researched. I'm not sure which. I think that the biggest difficulty that I had coming away from this 3.5 hour film was, is this man stupid or is he lying on purpose? Because, as I said, almost every idea presented in this film has been discredited for well over a century by hundreds of people with affirmed scholarship. So the only way you could come to these conclusions is if you wanted to. And I'm not saying that for the audience who has ingested the film, because I think that if you don't have the historical background, a lot of these things are presented confidently in such a way that you may believe that this man knows what he's talking about. He fucking doesn't. And the question that I had to wrestle with in preparing this episode was, am I talking about a liar or am I talking about a moron? And as a person who does not like to talk bad about black people, particularly in public, if I was talking about a moron, I didn't really want to do this episode. And then I pulled back and thought to myself, would a moron start a 3.5 hour film with 16 minutes of commercials and then end it with 9 minutes of commercials for other projects? No, probably not. Would a moron have a multi-book series, several films covering those books, an entire YouTube channel and entertainment network dedicated entirely to the idea that the Jews are the spawn of Satan and black people are actually the Israelites of the Bible? Probably not. So I'm leaning towards grifter, and that's why this episode is happening. And I think that something that doesn't get addressed enough in this discourse, particularly whenever the people who are having it are not informed on the source material, is that so much of this and how it's able to spread and how it's persisted for so long is because our education is fucked. I mean, we've talked about this to an extent back in season 2 when we discussed the Prussian education model. But that's just a baseline for this. We also have to discuss how black schools are, on average, so much worse equipped for properly educating children, giving people things like critical thinking skills, something that, like, no Americans are taught, and something that the guy who made this film throws out, like, the idea of magical thinking. Using critical thinking, we can arrive at this conclusion. No, using critical thinking, you would arrive at the opposite conclusion as the one that you're positing right now, so I don't know where the fuck you came up with that from, but we'll get into it. But my point is, black schools are typically disadvantaged in terms of education. And we've had these kinds of people in our communities presenting these pseudo-historical and asinine ideas since slavery ended, really. And the Great Migration spread them into cities, which made it easier for them to be transmitted to larger groups of people. And while it is fair to say that, regardless of how many times Mr. Dalton says that black people all over the world are en masse awakening to this idea, it's not actually that popular of a theory and only held by like 150,000 people worldwide. Things like this documentary being shared by someone in the NBA does sort of threaten to... what's it called whenever a virus breaks out of a control area? But it's still niche enough that I think it's important to, even though, like I said earlier, all of these ideas have already been debunked, debunk them again in a different medium. Because it's not necessarily sufficient to just say, oh, there's a lot of anti-Semitic bullshit in this film. What is that? And why is it bullshit? And how do you know that it's bullshit, Mox? Well, I'm going to tell you. So we're gonna get pretty heavy on things. I'm gonna turn the volume down on the mic because I promise you I'm gonna be yelling before I'm done with this. But I have a lot of notes on a lot of articles and a lot of things that I had to cross-reference and a whole lot of tabs pulled here from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. So, let's fucking go.
Okay, man, are you ready to go?
I'm ready to go. Now, come on, now, crank this motherfucker up.
So, I'm gonna be honest, it was sort of difficult to take notes on at least the beginning of this film because, as I said, it opens with 16 minutes of commercials and it's not really clear when the film is starting until about 14 and a half minutes in. But it opens with What is sort of one of the foundational ideas of Black Hebrew as realism, which is a vast misinterpretation of Deuteronomy 20, chapter 28, verse 68. And I'm going to read that for you now so that we can discuss it a bit. Quote, "And the Lord shall bring thee into Egypt again with ships, by the way whereof I spake unto thee, thou shalt see it no more again, and there ye shall be sold unto your enemies for bondmen and bondwomen, and no man shall buy you." End quote. And this is presented as a reference to something that's called the Curse of Ham. And this is also the first, in the first fucking 30 seconds, the first example of what is, to me, ironic self-hatred, because the Curse of Ham was really invoked by white people during the antebellum period as a justification for slavery, in that it's saying that in Deuteronomy, God is invoking a generational curse that made black people's skin black. So we've been cursed by God, and therefore slavery was justified. It was also popular in the United States during the abolitionist period as a religious justification for the West African slave trade. So the film, and really the ideology itself, opens up basing itself on an idea invented by white people to justify slavery as an explanation for why slavery happened. And that's where the film starts. From there, we go into a quote from Henry Ford in The International Jew, which those of you who've been listening to the show or are just familiar with it, no, The International Jew is just sort of a commentary on the protocols of the Elders of Zion that was first published in Henry Ford's Dearborn Independent newspaper in Michigan. And the I'm not going to give you the quote because it doesn't fucking matter. It's from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, for Christ's sake. And then the second quote presented is from, or I shouldn't say from, it is attributed to a man named Harold Wallace Rosenthal. And this man is actually quoted, or I should say paraquoted twice because it's actually a fake quote, in this film from a fake interview that is called The Hidden Tyranny. I'll get to that in a second. So Harold Wallace Rosenthal was a senior aide to Senator Jacob K. Javits, who was murdered on a flight to Istanbul, Turkey, in a terrorist attack in 1976. Why is that relevant? Because the interview that was published that quoted him, that's used in this film, came out in 1978, 3 years after he died. It's also been discredited by everyone as just a delivery system for, again, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. The pamphlet was originally published in 78, but it was republished in the 90s by an organization from Idaho, definitely not a place that's known for having the highest concentration of neo-Nazis in the world or anything, by a group called the 11th Hour Remnant Messenger, which is funded by Vincent Bertolini and Carl E. Story. For reference, the Anti-Defamation League has called it a fabricated document and questioned why the author would have waited until 1978, 18 months after the interview was supposed to have taken place, and 2 years after the guy was murdered. It's not just discredited by the Anti-Defamation League. Tom fucking Metzger said this thing was bullshit. Tom Metzger, those of you who are familiar with the show will remember him from the episode on the Brief History of American Fascism, as a former Grand Wizard of the KKK, the establisher of white Aryan resistance, and an all-around dope guy who has said on previous occasions that the Black Hebrew Israelite movement is cool, they're just the black version of us. So he, who actually thought that the Black Hebrew Israelites were cool because they were like the Black Klan and everything, also thought that this was a non-credible document. So there's that. So from the opening of the film, we have a misinterpretation of a quote from the Bible attributed to white slave owners in the antebellum South. And then a piece of propaganda invented by the Christian Identity Movement, because the 11th Hour Remnant Messenger was a Christian identity group that was founded by, as I said, Vincent Bertolini and Carl E. Story. Vincent Bertolini was also an associate of Richard Gernt Butler, the founder of the Aryan Nations, and the 11th Hour Remnant Messenger was specifically started in Sandpoint, Idaho, because there were no Jews there. So, the group that posited the quote used in the film was a Christian identity organization, and that's actually interesting because there's a whole lot of intersections between Christian identity and the Black Hebrew Israelites. Christian identity, if you're not familiar, is the British Israelite version of this whole we are the real Jews and the Jews are the spawn of Satan thing. The guy who shot up the Tree of Life synagogue was a Christian identity member. So this quote is actually from a Christian identity organization and has, as I said, been discredited by everyone from the Anti-Defamation League to the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. That's where we're starting. From there we go into, and this is sort of one of the muddier issues in discussing ideas associated with Black nationalism, because it's a fair point to make that we have been presented with images of white Jesus whenever geographically we know that doesn't really make any sense, and we're not white. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for us to pray to a white guy, right? But the misunderstanding here is that Jews played a part in the whitewashing of Jesus to somehow steal the ancestry of Black people. This is a farce for several reasons. The first of which is that the idea of Black people being presented with a white Jesus didn't really start happening until we got to America. If you look at the Ethiopian Jews and the Ethiopian Christians, the people that they're drawing pictures of and venerating were not white people. They were Black. It wasn't until slavery and Christianity began to be used as a means to justify the atrocities being committed on Black people that the idea that we were being watched over by a white God and a white Jesus was really presented. And it's a little bit earlier than that, because it was first really popularized by the Nazis. The idea of a white Jesus didn't really become popular until, like, the 20th century. I mean, it had been presented in some art, obviously, but people like God and Jesus weren't typically depicted in art until later on in history. And the idea of a white Jesus is really associated with something called positive Christianity, which is a movement within the Nazi party that was sort of based on racial purity of the German people and some elements of Nicene Christianity. Now, it's worth mentioning that Hitler did consider himself, but he at least called himself a Christian on several different occasions, in Mein Kampf and in several of his speeches, and he sort of referred to the Christianity of the Nazi Party as something that's called positive Christianity. In 1937, Hans Kerl, who was the Reich Minister of Church Affairs, explained that positive Christianity was not dependent upon the Apostles' Creed, nor was it dependent on faith in Christ as the Son of God, like regular Christianity. It was represented by the Nazi Party. Quote, "The Führer is the herald of a new revelation." Hitler's public presentation of positive Christianity as a traditional Christian faith was sort of different from that, though. He insisted on a unified peace within the churches because it was easier to control the churches if they were all getting along. So having a sort of homogenized version of Christianity that everybody really adhered to was the easiest way to accomplish that. And of course, you can't have a Christian church with a Jewish Christ. So the idea that Jesus was in fact Aryan became very, very popular. As I said, it's mentioned in Mein Kampf. Now, Jesus wasn't specifically Aryan previous to this, but the idea that he wasn't Jewish really traces back to the second century, and a group of Christians called the Marcionites, which sort of embraced a Gnostic version of Christianity as a rejection of the Jewish roots of the supposed genealogy of Jesus. So it was an attempt to distance new Christianity from its Jewish roots, and in so doing suggest that Jesus himself was not actually Jewish. He was European or Greek, something else. And honestly, like, we can have a fairly spirited debate about what the depictions of Christ, the papal decree that all depictions of Jesus would look like that one pope's son, positive Christianity and Nazi ideology, whitewashing Jesus, all of these things. We don't even know if the guy was fucking real, so I don't know how important it is what color people draw him as. I think that Jesus, much like God, represents spirituality for people, and therefore it's important to them that he looks like them, regardless of what they fucking look like. So if it makes you feel better to believe that Jesus was black, fine. There's no historical evidence outside of a few biblical references to hair like wool and skin like bronze and things of that nature, and the fact that we can trace about where we think he was born based on things in the Bible and what people historically from those regions looked like, and we can go from there. But again, if you want to draw the unicorn red, fucking have at it. It doesn't matter. And when I say that this whole thing is very modern, most people's impression of what Jesus looked like in this country comes from a painting that wasn't made until 1940. The Head of Christ. It's also known as the Solomon Head. It was painted by a man named Warner Solomon in 1940. It sold over 500 million copies, and it's sort of been presented as a, like, what people picture whenever you say Jesus. It's one of the most popular pieces of modern art ever. And it's only from the 1940s. So there's not really this old, old conspiracy to convince everyone that Jesus was white. That's kind of a fabrication. And this goes back to what we were talking about in the Mock Speaks 2 episode about how a lot of this stuff is founded in the need to feel special. And I understand and I sympathize with the need to feel special, especially in a society that tells you constantly that you're not. There are plenty of reasons for you to feel special as a black person. You don't need to make them up. And I also want to address the idea of a historical conspiracy to hide the original origins of the black people. What would that gain? Honestly, what would that gain? What do you gain from learning that you are the historically Israelite people of the Bible? Number one, the Bible is horseshit, by and large. It's based on oral tradition that was hundreds, if not thousands, of years old before it was written down. Most of it can't be proven. There is no geological or historical evidence that backs up most of the things that are in it. So we can start from the fact that a lot of your ideas are based on a book that has no historical basis whatsoever in many cases. Not all. There are some things that can be traced, but the last time I checked, we haven't found a fucking ark yet. So there's that. But let's say you are the Jews from the Bible. Now what? Are you or are you not still systemically oppressed in a society that has created laws, legislation, social norms, and all other manner of forms of oppression to keep you from succeeding, generationally speaking? Does you being a Jew change that somehow? Or do you now just wear a different hat while you make minimum wage working at McDonald's? I don't see how this improves your material conditions in any way whatsoever, besides how it is so very, 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 very obviously your white oppressors aiming you at another marginalized group of people and you being too fucking stupid to realize it. Let me calm down. Another basis for this idea that the Israelites of the Bible were black, and the Jews that we know now sort of co-opted their identity and started the slave trade. We'll get into that in a bit. Is something that's sort of been known for a while and has been discredited, called the Khazar Ashkenazi myth. Now, this idea has been around anti-Semitic circles since I think the late 19th century. All genetic studies that have been done on the Jewish people have found no substantive evidence whatsoever for a Khazar origin among Ashkenazi Jews. And as I said, it's called the Khazar Ashkenazi myth for a reason. The majority of contemporary geneticists who've published on the topic dismiss it entirely. Every once in a while, you find someone who defends it, like the 19th century scholar Ernst Renan. Renan was an anti-Semite and a French Orientalist who posited this idea that, and again, it was based around this idea that Jesus was white, that the Jews were in fact Turkish in origin and had migrated over a period of time from the general area in Turkey and Russia into other areas and had changed their name during an occupation within the Ottoman Empire from Khazars to Jews as like a way to blend in. Now, since the 19th century, the idea has become very, very popular with, again, the Christian identity movement, and the calling Jews Khazars is actually kind of a slur amongst anti-Semitic groups. It became really, really popular after 9/11, whenever a lot of these groups started, you know, blaming the Jews for 9/11. As it's conceived of in the Christian identity movement, apparently the Black Hebrew Israelite movement, and was conceived of by the Nazis, the Khazar Ashkenazi myth is sort of tied to something called the myth of the Red Jew, which is this mythical Jewish nation which appears in German mythology from the medieval period, like between the 13th and 15th centuries, that's tied to eschatological, I hate that word, stories about Gog and Magog. Basically, there's this tribe of heathens that's been trapped behind a wall in the Caucasus Mountains that's going to be released. And Gog and Magog are among the nations that are trapped behind this wall in an Alexandrian interpretation of the story. And there's been a lot of pamphlets that have circulated which interpreted the rise of Turkey in power as a context for this legend of the Red Jews. There's a tendency in the 16th century, for example, to refer to the rising Muslim empire as the mythical Red Jews. The Khazar Ashkenazi myth really got popular in the United States during the eugenicist period with people like Lothrop Stoddard, who was one of the early proponents of scientific racism, and wrote a book called The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy in 1920. Stoddard was a member of the KKK. He was also a founding member of the American Eugenics Society and the American Birth Control League. Books that he wrote actually influenced the Nazi government in Germany, and his book, The Revolt Against Civilization, The Menace of the Underman, actually introduced the term Untermensch into Nazi conceptions of race and society. Also championed by Hiram Wesley Evans, a former Imperial Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, Ezra Pound, and just a laundry list of really, really dope people, like every other idea in this film. Now, I don't want to misrepresent this. I am angry, but I don't want to bum everybody out for the entire episode of the show. So let's have some fun. What if I told you, listeners of Come and See, that one of the major bases for some of the ideas presented in this film was theosophy, and in fact, a black interpretation of the Lemurian hypothesis? Well, as it turns out, That's a thing. There are actually multiple examples of this, but the one that was my favorite, I sort of happened upon on accident. So one of the ways that I felt the need to research the content of the film was I wrote down every single name that this cat said in this documentary. It's not a documentary, Mox. And looked into who they were, what their scholarship was, if they were accredited, if they were ridiculous. And some of them you can't find anywhere, which makes me wonder if, in fact, they're made up. And some, for example, one that was referenced, a Dr. K. Loganatha Modarayan. There is one reference anywhere on the internet to that name. It's on a Facebook post made by somebody going by the name Ancient Alien Astronauts, referencing something called Kumari Kandam. Now, I wasn't familiar with Kumari Kandam, so I was sort of fascinated to look into this, and it's been kind of blowing my mind. Those of you who started listening to the show in season two and remember our looks into things like Helena Blavatsky and the Root Races and Lemuria and Atlantis and Vril and things of that nature are about to perhaps, as Mr. Dalton would have said in his film, have your minds blown. So, Kumari Kandam is a mythical continent that was believed to have been lost with an ancient Tamil civilization that was possibly located south of present-day India in the Indian Ocean. In the 19th century, some European and American scholars speculated the existence of a submerged continent called Lemuria, which we've talked about in the past. But there's a version of this in Tamil that's called Kumari Kandam. This sort of came about in the 20th century as a way to describe an Indian interpretation, specifically Tamil, of the Lemuria hypothesis. And we've discussed Lemuria at length as this idea that white people came up with in sort of the late 19th century to explain how white people had a unique evolutionary ancestor that you could have found on what is now an island that nobody could find called Lemuria. And in what has just become the most fascinating aspect of looking at the ideas of Black Hebrew Israelism to me is all of the ways that it mirrors white people's desire to maintain personal divinity and feel special through pseudoscience, pseudo-history, and a bunch of made-up mystical bullshit. A lot of it is just a Black interpretation of the exact same things. And here we have a prime example of it in a mystical island that explains a divergent evolutionary path of Black-looking people from the Indian region. And as is the issue with a lot of films like this, I liken it a lot to how Alex Jones presents ideas whenever he does interviews, particularly on other people's shows. The man just says this name and then presents it as, oh yeah, there's this idea of this island out there. And it's moved on from. It's not presented as, oh, by the way, this is not believed to be credible by literally anybody except for a handful of Tamil nationalists and apparently you. And it's now considered to be pseudo-geographical and kind of based on a myth. Like, a lot of the things you are presenting to your audience as historical fact, the way that these ideas are presented to the audience is, here's a question. Here's some stuff. Now that we've established that this is true, let's move on to the next idea. And hang on a second, you didn't establish that this was true. You threw out a bunch of names and a bunch of ideas associated with those names without giving any evidence of scholarship or merit whatsoever. And what you find when you look into the people that this man uses as evidence of scholarship, as authority on subject, they are clowns of their respective industries. I'm not done with theosophy yet, though. Another individual who's quoted several times in the film is Godfrey Higgins, Sir Godfrey Higgins, who is sort of one of the forefathers of the study of comparative religion in the 19th century. And he wrote a book called Anachalypsis, which was sort of an eschatological study into comparative religion based on the idea that all religions and religious myths trace back to a lost religion from Atlantis. It's not actually the only way he ties into shit that we've talked about on the show already. He was also a member of the Druidic Order, a hermetic order that predates the Order of the Golden Dawn. Now, that's not entirely substantiated, but he did write about the relationship between Druidic religions and the religions of the Jews rather extensively. His book, Anachalypsis, which was written in 1833 and didn't actually get published until 3 years after he died, was an attempt to review the history of religion again, sort of comparatively. It wasn't actually ever finished, though. But some of the ideas that are presented in it are that both the Druids, who, as you'll remember from earlier this season, weren't real, and the Jews both originated in India, and that Abraham from the Bible is actually Brahma, and that there is sort of a pan-deist global movement that's been covered up by the Christian church, that there is, in fact, a Christian conspiracy to hide a similar origin to all pagan and pre-Christian religions. That an idea that sort of turned into Prisca Theologia that we've discussed in the past. A lot of Godfrey's ideas about Atlantis, Lemuria, and comparative religion would go on to influence Helena Blavatsky in her conception of theosophy. Now, what's also worth pointing out is that Godfrey's ideas about a pagan origin for Judaism were very much adopted by groups that wished to paint the Jews as faux Abrahamic. This idea that the religion of the Jews does not trace back to the Old Testament, to the Torah, these things, that it's actually got this secret, hidden, conspiratorial background in a form of now unknown paganism. So in this, you have theosophical roots and, again, ideas by a white European occultist presented as a foundation for what is supposed to be black empowerment. So if you're keeping score of all of the ideas, the philosophers, the members of scholarship who have been named so far, almost entirely and exclusively anti-black. No actual black people, in fact. All white Europeans with a specifically anti-Semitic agenda that is being framed as a form of black empowerment, because you're expected to not understand the context from which these quotations and citations are being given to you. Several Greco-Roman philosophers, such as Pliny the Elder, Strabo, Herodotus, and several other known liars that we've discussed so far on the show this season in regards to the Druids, for example, come up repeatedly in the film. One of my favorite references, while we're keeping it light for a minute before I get angry again, in the film has to be this idea that he derives from the writings of Pliny the Elder, I guess, that the Pygmy Negrito tribe were the secret influence for the leprechauns. So we was leprechauns, black people. Regain your pride in your true identity. The leprechaun is based on the original Asiatic black man, or what the fuck ever. Also, apparently so was the Nephilim. So black people were both leprechauns and giants, and one of the reasons for the flood was because we needed to hide that that angels had bred with women and created these black god kings. So one of the ideas presented in this film that is now being touted as the hidden truth that is supposed to awaken the souls of the black man is that we have proof, quote unquote, that the Pygmy tribe were the first people discovered in Scotland, and that's where we got leprechauns from. So marinate on that. He also, I guess we're going to take a moment and dwell a bit on the intentionally bad faith scholarship of the film for a few minutes, I suppose. One of the other texts that's quoted is the Jewish Encyclopedia, and that is sort of referenced as a means of saying, here's Jews talking bad about themselves, which occurs repeatedly, and we're going to get into that in a little bit. But the Jewish Encyclopedia, as a means of giving sort of a full disclosure to this, was written by a man named Isidore Singer. And Isidore Singer held extremely liberal views, which endorsed both Jesus and the Christian New Testament, and proposed a Hebrew translation of the New Testament. He actually founded something called the Amos Society, which promoted understanding among followers of a monotheistic of other monotheistic religions. In 1897, he wrote a prospectus for the Encyclopedia Project, which was sort of a means of trying to create harmony between the disparate ideas spiritually between Jews and Christians, that suggested that the Jewish religion does not actually accord with what is suggested to be Judaism by most Jews. And it's also worth mentioning that the only reason he was used for the editor for the Jewish Encyclopedia was because Funk and Wagnalls made him divest from the project and appointed a group of scholars to check everything that he said. So the man who wrote the Jewish Encyclopedia was kind of an anti-Jewish Jew. On the subject of anti-Judaism, something that I guess this entire episode is really about when you get down to it, I mentioned earlier in the episode that Harold Rosenthal and a debunked letter or interview attributed to him is one of the things that's quoted multiple times in the film. The film also references an idea of a Jew-controlled media several times. And the second quote attributed to Rosenthal in the film is a long screed about how the Jews have secretly taken over the media and have made it look like they haven't, right? Now, I told you that quote is largely considered to have been debunked and is attributed to the Christian Identity Movement. Where you will find it, though, is in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And I'm going to read that for you real quick here. This is from Protocol number 12. Quote, "The word freedom, which can be interpreted in various ways, is defined by us as follows. Freedom is the right to do that which the law allows. This interpretation of the word will at the proper time be of service to us, because all freedom will thus be in our hands, since the laws will abolish or create only that which is desirable to us for us according to the aforesaid program. We shall deal with the press in the following way. What is the part played by the press today? It serves to excite and inflame those passions which are needed for our purpose, or else it serves selfish ends or parties. Selfish ends of parties, I apologize. It is often vapid, unjust, mendacious, and the majority of the public have not the slightest idea what ends the press really serves. We shall saddle and bridle it with a tight curb. We shall do the same also with all productions of the printing press. For where would be the sense of getting rid of the attacks of the press if we remain targets for pamphlets and books? The produce of publicity, which nowadays is a source of heavy expense owing to the necessity of censoring it, will be turned by us into a very lucrative source of income to our state. We shall lay on it a special stamp tax and require deposits of caution money before permitting the establishment of any organ of the press or of printing offices. These will then have to guarantee our government against any kind of attack on the part of the press. For any attempt to attack us, if such is still be possible, we shall inflict fines without mercy. Such measures as stamp tax, deposits of caution money, and fines secured by these deposits will bring in a huge income to the government. It is true that party organs might not spare money for the sake of publicity, but these we shall shut up at the second attack upon us. No one shall with impunity lay a finger on the areola of our government infallibility. The pretext for stopping any publication will be alleged plea that it is agitating the public mind without occasion of justification. I beg you to note that among those making attacks upon us will also be organs established by us, but they will attack exclusively points that we have predetermined to alter. Not a single announcement will reach the public without our control. Even now, this is already attained by us inasmuch as all news items are received by a few agencies in whose offices they are focused from all parts of the world. These agencies will then be already entirely ours, and will give publicity only to what we dictate to them, the Jew-run media. If already now we have contrived to possess ourselves of the minds of the Goy communities to such an extent that they all come near looking upon the events of the world through the colored glasses of those spectacles we are setting astride their noses, if already now there is not a single state where there exists for us any barriers to admittance into what Goy stupidity calls state secrets, what will our position be then, when we shall be acknowledged supreme lords of the world in the person of our king of all the world? End quote. So that's essentially the protocols of the Elders of Zion establishing that there is a secret plot amongst the Jews to take over the press through implementation of things like fines and censorship to control the media, an idea that is presented in this film no less than like six times. And I've always had sort of a mental block about the conversation regarding things like censorship and free speech in this country for various reasons, because the thing that has always kind of confounded me about this idea that, for example, in this particular case, the Jews will stop you from saying things about the Jews in the media, except you hear people say things about the Jews in the media all the time. Are there consumerist consequences for the things that people say? Abso-fucking-lutely. If you represent a brand and you say something stupid or something disagreeable or something that is not universally agreed upon by everyone, you may in fact affect your bottom line by making that statement. You were in fact allowed to make it. Kanye West spent like a month talking about the Jews on national television, on Twitter, on Instagram, and in front of anyone who would give him a fucking microphone and a camera. And we had a conversation about how you can't talk about the Jews. Did he or did he not just talk about the Jews? Is he dead? No. Did anything happen besides consequences of a free market enabling people to make the decision to no longer endorse him as a face of their product based on things that he was saying in the media? That's not the erosion of free speech. That's cause and effect. You said something that upset the people who buy their thing. They don't want you representing them anymore. That's not the same thing as, oh shit, you can't say anything about the Jews. You absolutely can. Evidenced by the fact that people do all the time, and they have been for thousands of years. Anti-Semitism is one of the most popular forms of bigotry on the planet, and one of the ways that it is maintained is that almost every anti-Semite you meet ever tells you that they're oppressed because they're an anti-Semite. One of the foundations of anti-Semitism in antiquity and throughout history is this idea that these people that you wouldn't let get jobs, who weren't allowed to live in the same part of town as everybody else, who had to wear stupid fucking hats so everybody knew who they were when they left the house, were somehow oppressing everybody else, hoarding all of the money, and telling the king what to do. The film also erroneously suggests that Jews did not arrive in Israel until 1948. As we've discussed previously on the show, in the episode about the protocols of the Elders of Zion, ironically enough, Jews started showing up in Palestine immediately after the pogroms started in the 1800s, and the Jewish aliyahs began earlier than that. There is a reference in the film to how Jews were not referenced anywhere in history before I think it was 500 BC, when in fact there are references in Assyrian texts to Jews 250 years earlier than that. And that's one of the reasons that I had to ask myself repeatedly, is the director stupid or lying? Because a cursory look into any of these sources shows a whole bunch of racists and a whole bunch of people who were discredited by other people with expertise in their field almost immediately, and a framework based on a text that's been discredited since 1905. In a discussion about the hidden African origins of Egypt, which doesn't have hidden African origins, it's in Africa, we talk about phrenology. The Crania Egyptologica is phrenological. So you have a black man trying to convince you of black superiority using Nazi theory, the protocols of the Elders of Zion, and phrenology. And also things like the Jewish Indian theory, which we're going to get into next. So by this point in the film, Mr. Dalton believes that he has established that the Jews, that the Israelites of the Bible are in fact the African black people. So whenever we get into a discussion of how the native indigenous American tribes are in fact, and as are the Mayans, by the way, we're going to get into that next, that the native indigenous tribes are in fact all black people. This idea is founded in something that is called the Jewish Indian theory that really came to popularity through someone who he references in the film named Thomas Thurgood, who was a Puritan minister from King's Lynn in Norfolk, England. He was one of the first English authors to really argue that indigenous people were descended from the lost 10 tribes of the Israelites. And basically, The idea was that the Indians of the United States had to have been, whatever white people got here, they had to try to rationalize how this group of people was already here. So there were a lot of various theories that they were descended from Egyptians, Carthaginians, people from Atlantis, the Chinese. There's still various theories about who can lay claim to actually being the first group of people here. The Moorish Science Temple teaches that it was black people, and that's why they secretly own all of the land. In this conception, Native Americans were Israelites, Hebrews, and Hebrews were black. Therefore, the Native Americans were black. Now, there is absolutely no genetic evidence whatsoever that backs this up, but there is one group of people who supports the idea historically: the Mormons. The Book of Mormon suggests that the Jewish people emigrated to the Americas after the destruction of the first temple of Israel, and it states that Jesus Christ appeared in the Americas and preached to Native Americans after he was resurrected. And the idea that there was a black group of natives called the Lamanites also appears in Mormon conception. In the Book of Mormon, the Lamanites are described as having received a skin of blackness to distinguish them from the white Native Americans, the Nephites, who also weren't real. The change in their skin color is often mentioned as a part of God's curse on the descendants of Laman, which you'll note sounds a lot like the curse of Ham, something that we talked about earlier in the episode. God cursed the descendants of Laman in the Book of Mormon for their wickedness and corruption. Quote, "And he had caused the cursing to come upon the Lamanites, yea, even a sore cursing, because of their iniquity. For behold, they had hardened their hearts against him, and they had become like unto a flint. Wherefore, as they were white, and exceedingly fair and delightsome, that they might not be enticing unto my people, the Lord God did cause a skin of blackness to come upon them." End quote. That's from 2 Nephi 5:21. After spending about an hour and 45 minutes dipping its toes into pseudoscience and pseudohistory and sort of heavily refuted DNA non-facts, the film really leans into the anti-Semitic undertones, and they really become overtones in the latter portion of the film by making assertions such as, in order to cover up the fact that they had stolen the Israelite identity of the black people, the Jews started the slave trade. Now, this is an idea that's been presented by people like David Icke, a lot of other prominent white supremacists and Nazi theorists. There's a very interesting article that discusses the roots of this that I'm going to quote for you now, called Slavery and the Jews, that was written in 1995 by Winthrop D. Jordan in The Atlantic. Quote, almost as soon as it appeared in 1991, the secret relationship generated a controversy that centered more on its intentions than its scholarship. The noise level was heightened in 1993 by the turmoil that swirled around Professor Tony Martin of Wellesley College. A tenured professor in Wellesley's Department of Africana Studies, Martin assigned to one of his classes portions of the book which singles out Jews for special prominence in the Atlantic slave trade and for having played a particularly prominent role in the enslavement of Africans in the Americas. He was, of course, accused of anti-Semitism, and wrote a brief book to refute the charges. The title of Martin's book, The Jewish Onslaught, Dispatches from the Wellesley Battlefront, gave a clear preview of his opinions. It was a mixture of discussion, factual refutation, and angry recrimination. The last predominated, with paragraphs that opened using language like, quote, to the Jews and to their favorite Negroes who have insisted on attacking me, I say, end quote. His views on the secret relationship's use of historical materials amounted to a barrage of enthusiastic endorsements. Ironically, Martin's assertion that, quote, Jews were very much in the mainstream of European society as far as the trade in African human beings was concerned, end quote, was very close to what many Jewish scholars had claimed some 30 years before. Martin, in one of his endorsements, made a startling assertion concerning slave ownership by Jews. Quote, using the research of Jewish historians, the book suggests that based on the 1830 census, Jews actually held a higher per capita slave ownership than for the white population as a whole. End quote. The secret relationship does in fact approach making that suggestion, and since the claim would appear to be a pivotal one, it's worth examining. In order to assess such a claim, one must resort to details. Martin's purported actuality is wrong on its face if applied to the, quote, white population of the United States, quote, as a whole, because in 1830 only a handful of white northerners still owned slaves. Jews were concentrated in the north, and they constituted a very small minority there. Even in the statement as is even if the statement is taken as applying only to the states in the American South that had not adopted gradual emancipation laws, it remains badly flawed. A careful and honest footnote in The Secret Relationship reveals that, quote, Jewish scholars had concluded that Jews in the South lived mostly in towns and cities. Neither this book nor Martin's explains the significance of this fact. In actuality, slave ownership was much more common in southern urban areas than in the southern countryside. The relatively high proportion of Jewish slaveholding was a function of the concentration of Jews in cities and towns, not of their descent or religion. It is also the case that urban slaveholders of whatever background owned fewer slaves on average than rural slaveholders, including those on large plantations. Thus, the proportion of slaveholders has never been an accurate measure of the social or economic importance of slaveholding, unless it is assessed on a broadly regional or state-by-state basis. In this instance, as in so many others, the statistical data do not stand up and cry out their own true significance. The book is interesting in many respects, though. It is an unnamed editor and provides no indication of personal ownership. authorship. The title page declares that it was, quote, prepared by the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam, end quote, but does not explain why this is volume one, or may be offered in ensuing volumes, or what may be offered in ensuing volumes. The book is ostensibly a scholarly work, replete with a short bibliography and a huge collection of footnotes. In opening, quote, note on sources, it asserts that, quote, it has been compiled primarily from Jewish historical literature, end quote. A second title page of The Secret Relationship announces, quote, that blacks and Jews have recently begun to question their relationship and its strategic role in their individual development, end quote, and that the book is, quote, intended to provide an historical perspective for intellectual debate of this crucial social matter, end quote. The word individual raises the question whether persons or groups are intended. Individual African Americans and individual Jews as persons, or two distinct individual groups. The film actually does the exact same thing multiple times, I think it's interesting to point out. As for the mechanics of scholarship, they present a central difficulty. The footnotes are extremely difficult to check in the form in which they are presented, although they follow the custom in common with most of the humanities, but not the social sciences, of providing a complete citation upon first mention and a shortened author title page version for ensuing ones, and are placed at the bottom of the page. They are numbered consecutively, all 1,275 of them, rather than starting afresh with each chapter. A reader encountering a brief reference to a presumably important article on Jewish slaveholding in the South, such as one on page 304 in footnote number 1,238, can find a fuller citation on page 91 in footnote number 349, only after nearly an hour of thumbing through the book. Having gone this far, the reader must then consult the footnote abbreviations at the beginning of the book in order to discover a reference that might be usable in a library. The citation names a three-volume work edited by Abraham J. Karp. Upon consulting that work, which actually has five volumes, one learns that the article in question is by Bertram W. Korn. The same article by Korn is listed in the Secret Relationship Selected Bibliography, but in another set of volumes with an incorrect date and no indication that it was reprinted elsewhere several times. Footnotes matter because verifiability depends on them. In the Karp-Korn instance, we are nearly home, though we do not yet know when the article was published, and of course the date matters greatly. We can determine it only by consulting actual copies of the article, which turns out to be, quote, Jews and Negro Slavery in the Old South, 1789 to 1865, which originated as an address by the president of the American Jewish Historical Society and was first published in 1961. The date, as it turns out, falls within a period when Jewish scholarship about the history of Jews in the United States was moving away from predominantly filio-pietistic studies of ancestry and achievement and towards a more sophisticated assessment of the role of Jews in American culture. Korn's article contains a great deal of specific information to which the secret relationship has been thoroughly faithful. Overall, though, the conclusions Korn drew from his data were very different. He made a strong and persuasive case that there were few Jews in the planting class in the South, that Jews had historically been forced into commercial enterprises, that in the Old South they were typically city dwellers, that a small number participated in the domestic slave trade, that they treated their slaves no better or worse than other slaveholders, and that the few Jews in the South, without exception, endorsed slavery. The thrust of Korn's article was that Jews were not much different from other white Southerners in their views on race and slavery. Dating such historical writing is critical, of course, given the shifting state of historical scholarship over time. Many of the works cited in The Secret Relationship are so old that it would be generous to call them outdated. Of the first 60-odd, nearly a third date from before 1950, and eight from the 1890s. In contrast, a recent pamphlet on the Atlantic slave trade that was published by the American Historical Association as an aid to scholars and teachers cites four sources that date from 1949 through the late 1960s and 28 published since 1970. Yet, surely the compilers of The Secret Relationship will feel that such disparities merely confirm their case. That by avoiding these older historical writings, the history establishment has been hiding the facts about the important role played by Jews in the enslavement of Africans and their descendants in the New World. The AHA pamphlet does not, in fact, even mention Jews. The compilers will no doubt take this omission as further confirmation that the participation of Jews has been kept a secret. A more serious difficulty with The Secret Relationship lies in its general stance toward historical evidence. The compilers assumed that the book would be most persuasive if it were based almost entirely on, quote, Jewish sources. That is, retrospective histories written by Jews, and that there would be general agreement with the proposition that each group can most persuasively write its own history, a proposition that most historians find either naive or dangerous, or both. On occasion, this strategy deprives The Secret Relationship of evidence that would have bolstered its case, as with estimates of the total number of Africans killed by the Atlantic slave trade. The compilers cite figures gathered by both Jewish and non-Jewish Western historians, but ignore the higher estimates claimed by Joseph Inokori, an established scholar from Nigeria. The compilers have avoided another distinction that most historians regard as crucial, that between primary sources written at the time and secondary ones written later on the basis of the primary sources. The evidence presented in the footnotes consists almost entirely of secondary historical accounts, written mostly by Jews and often in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, when Jews newly arrived from Europe were trying to establish themselves as full participants in their new country. At that time, many of those immigrants saw the African slave trade and slavery as a key feature of the American experience and participation in it as truly American. In fact, it was. Many of these early Jewish American writers thus missed the hideousness and the tragedy of what they were describing. Even Korn's 1961 article today seems downright blind to the suffering of the victims of the slave trade and their descendants. Since then, however, Jewish American scholars have written some of the best studies of the internal workings of African American slave communities in North America and have been applauded by many African American scholars for their understanding. In assessing most historical works, it is necessary to focus on mere details on the minutiae that constitute the evidentiary base of the enterprise. The Secret Relationship includes numerous lists of Jewish shipowners and slaveholders. Its final chapter catalogs the involvement of numerous people with Jewish names who are documented as having participated in the persecution of Africans and especially African Americans. In addition, there are 17 tables based on official U.S. Census data. These are drawn from the years 1790, 1820, and 1830, simply because those years are mentioned in secondary accounts written by Jews. There has been no analysis of the original data. The census of 1850 and 1860 are not considered, although the data from those 2 years were more informative. And to many readers, quibbling about census material may seem trivial, but when one gets down to individual cases, names, and details are more important in any historical work. The city of Newport, Rhode Island was indeed active in the 18th century slave and rum trades, and it had a flourishing community of Jewish merchants. This is actually referenced in the film. Readers of The Secret Relationship are told that the writing of Jewish historians, quote, seems to suggest that all the stills in Newport were owned by the Jews, end quote, in the 18th century. So much for the making of rum, a commodity commonly used in the slave trade and also a direct product of that same traffic. But what, then, is one to make of the fact that members of the Coggeshall family, who first came to Rhode Island as Quakers and later switched to the Church of England, were in the business of distilling on the eve of the American Revolution? In 1772, both Nathaniel Coggeshall's father and son, were distillers. Readers wanting to explore such a matter will not be helped by the book's index, which has no entry under Newport, even though that little city is discussed or mentioned on at least 8 pages. Similarly, there are no entries for much briefer mentions of Natchez in New Orleans, though other cities are there, such as Detroit, not in the D's, but in the M's, under Michigan. There are several interrelated problems with this study, of course. It sets out to reshape the prevailing historical record concerning the treatment of Africans and African Americans during the period of the slave trade and slavery. Far from asking any question at all, this book begins with an answer, that Jews were especially important in exploiting Africans. It is able to demonstrate, at least ostensibly, that they were. This is the central difficulty. The book sets out to prove a thesis and pays little attention to evidence that might modify or contradict it. If one were to inquire more neutrally into what roles Jews played in the Atlantic slave trade, one would find that it was a considerable one during the formative years of the trade in the 16th and 17th centuries, and a very small one when the trade reached much greater volume in the 18th and early 19th centuries. This change in the role of Jews relative to the roles of other Europeans had to do with shifts in power and culture that occurred among various Atlantic European nations over a period of some 500 years. The trade was dominated first by the Portuguese, then by the Dutch, and then by the English, and to a much lesser extent, the French. The reasons for the important role of Jews in the early years of the slave trade are not hard to find. To put the matter in summary terms, Jews in medieval Europe had collectively been pushed by the Western branch of the Christian Church away from land ownership and into commerce and financial dealings. During those early years of Western overseas expansion, many Jews continued to find opportunities for drawing wealth from commerce and finance. Under heavy threat in the 16th and 17th centuries, many Portuguese and Spanish Jews found refuge in the Netherlands, a quasi-nation that by that time had a widely reputed tolerance for religious diversity. You'll note that the zealots who ended up here went there first, and they were in fact too crazy for them. Jewish citizens of the Netherlands were able to participate in domestic and foreign trade, including the slave trade on the coast of West Africa and in the Americas. These Jews, along with many Christian Dutch traders, supplied slaves not only to the Dutch colonial enterprises in Brazil and Suriname, but also to Curaçao and other islands in the Antilles for transshipment to the New World colonies of other European nations. Ironically, Jews were therefore able to make major investments in landed enterprises, which in tropical America meant slave plantations in Brazil and then Suriname. This brutal trade in human beings was carried on by various African peoples and socio-political entities in West and West Central Africa. The participation of these groups also waxed and waned over the 500-year period. Internal developments in Africa played an important part in determining how the trade varied from place to place and from time to time. The expansion of the Dahomey and of the Asante Kingdom, for example, along with the declension of power in Oyo, had fully as much effect upon neighboring African peoples as the different but roughly parallel shifts in the balance of power among European nations had upon Europe. Developments in Africa are, of course, not the concern of the secret relationship. Owing to the nature of available data, historians will never know as much about international, inter-ethnic, and inter-religious conflicts in Western Africa as they know about those in Western Europe. In the latter region, Protestants, Jews, and Roman Catholics, who lived in several political entities, traded in human beings with a great many more societies in Africa, whose members thought of their differences in such distinct terms as to defy comparison, but to whom such differences also mattered greatly. One aspect of the present issue, however, is utterly clear. By focusing on the importance of the activities of one internationally distributed religious group of Europeans, the Jews, the book ignores diversities in Africa. In addition, by treating Africans as mere objects of trade, it deprives all Africans of their own agency, of their capacity to control or at least deal with their lives and their history, including the activities of powerful men who enslaved other Africans and traded them to Europeans. In effect, it treats millions of African people as a mere undifferentiated blob, a pool of helpless victims totally lacking in the perception, will, and power necessary to resist or to take advantage of economic opportunities. Such a focus radically distorts the historical record, of course. This theme also has a depressingly familiar ring, because for many years, white Americans were saying almost exactly the same thing about black Americans. The dusty old image is still clear in its reverberatory way. Those people really couldn't accomplish anything, for they were always and inherently acted upon, rather than taking active roles in determining their own fates. Thus, the reader is thrust backward in time, forced to stare at facing mirrors. The reflections bounce back and forth, continually conveying the earliest images generated not on the West African coast, but in Western Europe and in its New World settlements. Those images originated with the oppressors and not with the oppressed. And that's, end quote, that's one of my primary issues with this film and the source material that it chooses to use, is that it is basing itself as an emancipation of the black mind and a way to free black people from the mental oppression of the lie of where we truly come from. And it's basing all of it on lies invented by Europeans, many of whom were actively racist. And the film also, you know, I don't want to just hammer how angry a lot of this material makes me. I do want to present the idea that, you know, the film goes into the commonalities of emotion in many black Americans, and it discusses resentment, stress, rage, concern for the future, a feeling of being disadvantaged and intentionally held back. Every black American in this country can relate to those things. They're not the result of the Jews attempting to hold down the black population. They are the result of systemic racism, something that has been furthered by a lot of the people who are cited in this film. Ideas presented by eugenicists, social Darwinists, the Christian identity movement, white supremacists, Adolf Hitler, Henry Ford. There's the references to Nasser in this, in the Pan-Arabian movement. These are not groups of people who were acting with your best interests in mind. They were acting to the detriment of the Jewish people, more often than not. A group that you are now contributing to the persecution of by normalizing talking points that, again, were introduced by people who would just as soon kill you too. In the segment of the film that discusses people who historically have stood up against the Jewish hoax, Mr. Dalton references Gamal Abdel Nasser, the second president of Egypt, who you'll remember was assassinated after trying to implement Pan-Arabianism, Henry Ford, who we've done an entire goddamn episode of this show about, who, in addition to being one of the most anti-Semitic men on the planet, I mean, Adolf Hitler had his portrait in his fucking office. He hated black people. He thought that they were incapable of thinking for themselves, and he refused to allow them to do anything besides clean the machinery and the most dangerous jobs that usually killed people. Adolf Hitler, and the two quotes to Adolf Hitler aren't even properly attributed. They're not actual Hitler quotes, but just the idea that you're suggesting that Adolf Hitler was a friend to the black community. King Leopold II, who I think is a man who needs no introduction, and Titus Flavius Josephus, a man who is widely discredited for his theories on how race and religion should have played a part in who did and didn't get enslaved, and who has been discredited by historians as someone who's not reliable or accurate in their depictions of anything. In the wrap-up to the film, Mr. Dalton quotes Marcus Garvey in discussing a tree without roots as an allegory for the black people. And I find that ironic, because the roots of Mr. Dalton's ideology are founded in white supremacy, disguised as black supremacy, as a vehicle to attack the Jewish people, which is even more ironic because one of the main canards of most white supremacists in the United States is that the Jews have been astroturfing the civil rights movement since the 1950s as a Trojan horse for global communism. So you, my brother, have given your oppressor exactly what he wants. You are a walking, talking mouthpiece for all of his ideas, and you've convinced yourself that they're your own and that you somehow derive power and a sense of identity from believing a bunch of bullshit made up by slave-owning crackers. I consider myself to be a black liberationist and a black nationalist to some extent, and that's why this has been such a difficult time period for me. I love my people. We are exceptional. We are responsible for the arts, for music, for dance, for fashion, for agriculture, mathematics, sciences. White people looked at what we were doing in Egypt centuries ago and called it magic because they didn't know what it was. And then they lost their fucking minds trying to recreate it for centuries. We had the greatest advances in alchemy, in government, in education, in sociology, in representative government, women in positions of power. We were at the forefront of everything for millennia. And this idea that some proud heritage has been stolen from you and you need to reclaim it by basically being a black version of a Christian identity adherent is so depressing, because your heritage is so proud if you would just take it. Just accept it for what it is, that we have been oppressed, we have experienced adversity, and we have, in the face of all of that, in a society that has done everything in its power to make sure we can't succeed, we're some of the most exceptional people on the planet. IQ was invented to try to make us look stupid. The highest rated IQs on the planet are black children under the age of 18. You are part of a proud tradition of amazing people, and you don't have to make anything up to drive that point home. There is no great awakening that needs to take place within you other than the fact that you hate yourself and that's why you think this shit. Why is it everyone on the planet wants to be black but black people? You got white people trying to talk like us. You got Asian people trying to talk like us. You got Mexican people trying to talk like us. You got European people still trying to dress like Tupac Shakur in 2022. And the only people in the world trying to act like something other than black people are black people. And that makes me sad. Because it's not necessary. There is pride in your heritage that you don't have to invent. And you sure as fuck don't need to look to Nazis for reasons to be proud of who you are. And if I can say anything directly to Ronald Dalton Jr., because I'm going to assume you're going to hear this, I weep for what America has done to your mind. Because I see a brother who clearly has the capacity to, for curiosity, for creativity, for that black excellence that I was just fucking talking about. It's in there and it's stifled by bullshit, propaganda, pseudo-history, and a need to blame your disadvantages on the Jews. And that ain't the deal, bro. Like the Jews are just as disadvantaged as any other group of people who ain't cishet white people on this planet. That's the name of the game, and that's where your ideas came from. That's where the protocols of the Elders of Zion came from. What do you think Henry Ford was, if not a white supremacist? We need to teach black people more frequently that the Nazis invaded Germany. I mean, I'm sorry, that the Nazis invaded Africa. So every couple of weeks, I don't have to hear a black person talk about what a genius Adolf Hitler was. Y'all remember him having a meltdown whenever Jesse Owens whooped Germany's ass in the Olympics, right? You know, he didn't love black people. He just hated other people, too. And you spreading his ideas as some sort of evidence of your superiority just makes you look dumb. And I'm sorry that you hate yourself. I hope one day you don't. I understand that in a lot of ways, it's not your fault. This country did this to you. And It's a shame that we all have had to experience the generational trauma of something that now a lot of you like to pretend didn't even happen. You know that our history, this narrative that our history was stolen from us and we need to reclaim it by becoming aware of the Black Hebrew Israelite heritage of our people. Our history has been stolen from us. You are helping. Don't get me wrong. I know your people's last name ain't Campbell. I know it ain't Washington. I know it ain't Jefferson. I know most of us have no idea where the fuck we came from. And I understand the anger and resentment and confusion and feeling of loss that goes along with that, and how some days just looking like you can feel like a curse, but it's not. They put that in your head. Stop letting them do that to you. You are Black, you are beautiful, you are exceptional, and for the love of God, you're not a fucking Hebrew. So that's all I got on From Hebrews to Negroes, y'all. That's the material for today's episode. I hope this was informative for you. I know that this has been kind of a hot button issue, so I hope that some of this helps you in perhaps some of the discourse you're going to have with loved ones, because as these ideas have been prevalent in the Black community for like 200 years, you're probably related to somebody who thinks it if you're Black. I'm sorry. Like, and that's a shame. That's a thing that we as a community really need to figure out a way to fix the way that we educate our people so that we're not falling constantly for conspiratorial bullshit like this. And stick a fucking fork in me, listeners. I'm done for the day. So we'll be back. Same Mox time, same Mox channel. Tomorrow, in fact, when we return to our regularly scheduled programming with an episode about David Duke and the modern KKK, because apparently my turnaround from talking about anti-Semitism is talking about the Klan. I guess I should take a nap in between doing that. I did want to mention a few things as clerical stuff before we wrap up for the day. I missed a shout-out to the newest member of the Hep Cult, Julia. Welcome aboard. Thank you for joining up with the Hep Cult. We appreciate you. Those of you who would like to become members of the cult can do so at www.patreon.com/comeandseepod. There's a few different tiers for you available to choose from that'll allow you, if you would so feel so inclined, to help me keep the lights on. Additionally, we're going to have a pre-order running here in the next week or so for, I'm doing a, collaboration with Black Forge Coffee Company, for, my own special blend of Come and See Coffee. And we're going to be running a pre-order for that here as soon as I get the artwork available to post up with that. So, if you're interested in what I might taste like if I were a coffee, that'll be available for you here, hopefully in the next little while. So pre-orders for that will be on the Facebook page. We might throw something on Twitter. I'll try to put that somewhere where you can see it, and we'll get the ball rolling on that. And that'll actually be the first merch that we've had available for the show. So, that's exciting. Other than that, we'll be back on Monday with an episode about David Duke. I think I covered that already. And, in the meantime, concentrate on the Hep, everybody. I have been Moxie O'Brien. This has been Come and See, and I will catch all of you beautiful people on the flip side. Smooches, deuces, dig it.
I'm finished.